This is Sarah Stewart Holland.
And this is Beth Silvers.
Thank you for joining us for Pantsuit Politics.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for a new episode of Pantsuit Politics. We made it through all 15 ballots of speaker voting and hope that you did as well. I spent more time on C-SPAN than I thought was possible. So we're going to talk about that today. We are going to talk about the January 6th committee's work and its report. We're going to talk about an unfortunate export of January 6th from the United States to Brazil. And then we are going to completely change the mood by bringing in Casper Turkile for a delightful conversation about connecting with one another more fully. And outside of politics, we're going to celebrate all the holiday cards that you all sent us. It was a blessing, and we're going to commemorate the blessing today.
Now, don't forget, if you want to be a part of our January 6th Report Book Club, make sure you're signed up for our premium content on either Apple Podcast subscription or Patreon. Beth, you had an interesting interaction this weekend about our premium content that I thought would be a nice moment to remind people what it actually is.
I did. My sweet friend Phyllis from church came up to me on Sunday. She became a premium supporter just because she loves the show and wanted to support our work, which means so much to me. It always hits you when somebody in your real life, you know, cares that much about your work. So Phyllis said that until she listened to our year-end compilation of the episodes that I did from More to Say About Mar-a-Lago, she didn't really understand what she might have been missing in the premium content. And Sarah, it made me think about how I think we do a disservice to our premium content when we talk about it as bonus content. Because the truth is, we make two other podcasts. That's what we do. And they are behind a paywall. Sarah makes a Good Morning podcast where she does the headlines Monday through Thursday. It's funny. It's delightful. It gives you everything that you need to know. It's curated, so you don't have to decide what's important. Sarah decides for you. And it is a really lovely way to start the day every day. And then on Monday through Wednesday by myself, I make a podcast about one particular topic that I just have more to say about. That is why it's called More to Say. And Sarah joins me there on Thursday for what is really like another episode of Pantsuit Politics, but we get a little spicier. We like to provide some of our hot takes there.
And there's cursing. The people love the cursing. They live for the cursing. We had cursing last week on Thursday due to the speaker race. People loved it. And Wednesdays, we're going to be together the next few weeks because that's where we're going to cover the January 6th book club. And listen, Phyllis, it wasn't even her fault. Like, the Patreon app was not letting her click through the content. She had to reinstall it. It's just stuff like that that sometimes I think we're all busy. We're all trying to get through life. You sign up because you support us and maybe don't. You know, the apps can be confusing adding that, but we are here to support you. You can reach out to our team at any time if you feel like you're not getting the full benefit or if you want to learn more. We are here. The people who support us financially make this podcast possible. We're not breaking any new ground here when we say that advertising is fickle. And so having the steady support of our listeners is how we can expand our team and continue to do more and better work for all of you.
Next up, we are going to talk about the endless speaker race that finally came to conclusion.
Lord. Have you ever experienced a dry, itchy scalp or ever wondered why your color isn't lasting as long as your hairdresser promised? Well, unfiltered, mineral-filled water could be the reason why. Did you know hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin? And that about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered showerhead comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered showerhead. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered showerhead is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze. We put it in, it took like 30 seconds, guys. And its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered showerhead purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine is at about 50%, and I'll tell you why. I have a tendency to overcommit. I want to help with everything I can possibly help with. I want to do everything I can possibly do. I want to be with people and I forget that at the end of the day, I am an introvert and I really need time to recharge and take care of myself. Therapy gives me important tools to do that, to recognize what's going on, to understand my battery and where it is and why it's there and what I can do to recharge. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/pantsuit. So that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it, but I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters doing the Olive and June mani system at home, because we can all get a good looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon grade tools that are so easily explained so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. The Olive and June mani system is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first mani system.
After 15 ballots, we have a new Speaker of the House. Kevin McCarthy is the 55th Speaker. I always like to hear numbers like that to just think through how long our country's been around, how few people get to do these jobs. Mm-hmm. And now it's Kevin. He wanted it the worst and he got it.
Well, and also to remind us, it's probably not the first bozo to do this job. Out of 55, there were some bozos, I promise.
So there's a vote scheduled on Monday evening. We're recording Monday afternoon on the rules package, which had some negotiations with the 20 holdouts. But most of the negotiations with the 20 holdouts have not really been put in a form where the entire caucus has had a chance to take a look at them. And there's some unhappiness about that. So I love the people who are pointing out the easiest vote that you should take in Congress is for the speaker, and the second easiest should be for the rules. And there's no ease in this process.
I was very struck by Matt Gaetz, who got in a physical altercation before this final vote. That's fun. That's a fun addition to the history books, saying, I ran out of things to ask for. And I think this agreement, as much as we do know about it, is a complete capitulation to the conservative caucus. I thought the New York Times did a good write-up on this in the morning today as we're recording on Monday, which said, these sound so common sense. They sound good, right? Like, give people time to read. Let them make amendments. But this is just going to serve a complete slowdown, if not total gridlock, in the House of Representatives. Even the stuff they're already proposing, they know is not going to make it out of the Senate. It just is hard to look at this first vote, this rules package, and think anything is going to happen in the House of Representatives over the next 2 years, except for, of course, investigations.
I look at the rules package and see not a lot of new ideas. They're restoring a lot of rules from times when Republicans have previously controlled the House. I think what's different here is the fact that you cannot imagine McCarthy being able to steer almost any substantive vote forward without losing four members of his caucus. I think that's what's new. They're going to take all of these votes that are purely symbolic for ideas that will never go anywhere in the Senate, but every House of Representatives does that. Mm-hmm. Democrats just did it, and Republicans are going to do it. A lot of it will be obnoxious investigations, TV time, grandstanding. We've seen that before. It'll be orders of magnitude worse here because of the kind of dissent of the Republican Party, you know, outside of anything resembling the people's business. But overall, I'm kind of struggling with how consequential, especially, are the rules negotiations. I think what's more consequential are the committee assignments, the people who are going to be in place to implement the rules, because these rules are like self-enforcing. You know, if they want to get things done, they will waive the things in their way of getting things done. It's more about the personnel side of this.
To the personnel aspect, both the people on the committees and Kevin McCarthy himself, the Washington Post had a great write-up about how this all happened. And it was just, you know, after so many ballots to read about, the fall apart happened because of unforced errors from McCarthy. Like, he insulted these people. He put details in there that were really not what they were asking for, I guess assuming they weren't going to read it. He yelled at them in a caucus meeting, which then, of course, just hardened everybody's position. It's just, he's so bad at this job. And now he's made the job that he's already not good at that much harder. And he's empowered people who, although I find abhorrent, the likes of Jim Jordan and Biggs and Perry, like, they're a little bit better at this game than he is. And now he's empowered them by putting him in these positions of power on committees. And it's just, that's my analysis. Ugh.
What I think is the big takeaway from the past few days is that the people who have power in the House are the people who take it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the people who are good at this know, the Jordans, the Biggs, the Gates, the Perrys, they know there are 435 of us and we are equals until we decide not to be anymore. And it's what bugs me the most in seeing how for 4 days, as we don't have members sworn in, we have so few people willing to say, what can I do to help here? It's just everybody dug in to their positions instead of anybody saying, what would actually be helpful? My fan fiction version of this is that I very much wish somebody like Josh Gottheimer would have stood up and said, you know what? I'm a Democrat. I do not want a Republican speaker, but that's how the chips have fallen. So I would like to nominate the co-chair of the Problem Solvers Caucus, Brian Fitzpatrick, for this position. Because here we were in a situation that was a problem that needed solving. And I would have loved to see a coalition of members who say they do that stuff take as much power as the Freedom Caucus guys take.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, it's just so disturbing. As we mentioned at the top of the show, we are in the midst of reading the January 6th report with our premium community. And I'm sitting here reading this report, reading about Donald Trump's actions on January 6th in great detail, reading about Kevin McCarthy's interactions with Donald Trump post-January 6th. And he finally takes this gavel, stands up, and just praises him so effusively. And, you know, back to that Washington Post thing, they talked about, like, he didn't really sway that many people, and he seemed completely bored with it. He doesn't care about this stuff. He doesn't care about the details of what the Freedom Caucus are asking for. And they know that. That's why they weren't taking his calls on the floor of the House when Marjorie Taylor Greene was trying to hand him a cell phone. So it's just, to watch McCarthy, again, not good at this job, stand up there and praise him, like, in the midst of reading this. And then especially the next day, with the events in Brazil, it just was so disturbing, like, to that sort of naked power grab. And the people who tried to grab power on January 6th in the most treasonous way, still up there on committees, still up there talking, still up there praising Donald Trump, was just so disturbing.
It was. And I really do expect Democrats to try to be helpful in this situation, because it is such a bad situation. I was bummed by the speech that everybody loved from Representative Jeffries, the ABCs of why Democrats are better than Republicans. Like, congrats. Yes, you are. I got it. It's asymmetrical here. And also, if this is as bad as I think it is, if the fact that the key players in the speaker drama, including McCarthy himself, were all referred to the Ethics Committee for defying legally issued subpoenas from the January 6th committee is as big a deal as it sounds like, I don't want a really cool speech about how much they suck. I want people to get together and exercise the power they have to get in there and get something out of these negotiations so this body can function as well as it can, given the representatives that the American people have sent there.
I just don't know what they do, honestly. Like, I just, you know, I'm not doubting that members of the Democratic caucus, particularly whose lives were in danger on January 6th, feel and understand this threat. I don't think there's any love lost with people like Jim Jordan and Andy Biggs. But I don't, you know, when you're dealing with particularly the Freedom Caucus, that will take that power, that does not operate in good faith, and a completely bankrupt leadership. Like, what? I don't know what they would do. Honestly, I don't know what they're supposed to do. I mean, besides stick to the January 6th committee, which they did, make these criminal referrals, follow that process out. Like, I'm not really sure what that would look like.
I mean, I think it would look like people from the center trying to gather other people from the center and say, can we get to a governing 50+1% of this body? Because we know that it's only going to get harder from here when we're looking at debt ceiling fights, when we're looking at funding for Ukraine, the appropriations process. Like, we need a governing majority, and that's not going to come through party line votes because the Republicans are not going to be able to hold those together.
I just think that's really hard because their center is Nancy Mace. Like, I would struggle to negotiate with somebody like her. Like, the center, I think it's, we can say, well, the center, but there's not really the center. There's the Democratic center, and then there's the Republican center, and they're pretty far apart.
100%. It's not going to be easy to watch it all fall apart either. We don't send people to do these jobs for it to be easy. It is hard. And just everybody being intransigent, we know what it's going to produce. We just watched it, right? And I don't want that to be for 2 years.
Well, I just think, though, that's the motivation, though. I remember that political scientist on the Ezra Klein podcast a while back saying, like, when power changes hands so frequently, particularly in the House of Representatives, there's not a lot of motivation because you're thinking, well, in a year and a half, we'll be campaigning on what failures they are and we can take back control. And so that's the political motivation, is just to contain the damage, blame it on them, and take back control. And that, again, that's kind of hard to argue with.
But it's a waste. And it's a waste of everyone's one wild and precious life and opportunity to serve in these positions that so few people get to serve in. And I just think we are in such an insane cycle of doing the same thing and expecting anything to be different. We talked about the January 6th report a little bit. Let's talk a little bit more about that, because we were off on winter break during the final hearing and report. As you know now, the committee in that final hearing summed up its case against the former president and outlined the criminal charges it thinks should be brought against him. Sarah, especially as I am reading the final report, it seems clear to me that this whole criminal referral debate that the committee struggled with is really just Congress saying to the Department of Justice, hello from your co-equal branch of government. Please do not go after the little guys and neglect the people with the most culpability. Do it with your tools. Do it the way you think you need to. Do it under the charges you think you can win. But don't let the big guys off the hook when you are pursuing the little guys so hard.
Well, and I think that's so prescient now that we're watching our January 6th export spread to Brazil, that you cannot focus on the protesters. I think Brazil is a more difficult case. For those of you who are not following the news closely, over the weekend, on Sunday in Brazil, after the swearing in of Lula, the new president of Brazil, thousands of protesters stormed their capital, both the Supreme Court building, the congressional building, and the presidential palace. These protesters didn't appear out of nowhere. They have been occupying military barracks across the country since the election in October. So there was a march. They were never seemingly stopped by any federal security officials on the ground in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil. And so they went all the way. They did an enormous amount of damage. There's some pretty horrific video of the treatment of police on the ground. The buildings have been taken back. This is, again, same song, different verse. Hundreds of people have been arrested. And so now Brazil is facing this fallout, much like we did after January 6th, and asking those questions. How were they able to get through so clearly? How do we deal with the thousands of protesters who did the physical damage? What do we do with the people that were perhaps organizing from the top? There's been discussion that Bolsonaro, who's currently in the United States, son, has been working with Steve Bannon, who makes many, many appearances in the January 6th report. So it's just so depressing to be reading this report, watching the speaker election in the House and Kevin McCarthy's speech, then the events in Brazil. And then this morning, like, listening to the BBC Global News say over and over again, well, this echoes the events in the United States. This echoes the terrible events in the United States. It's just depressing. It's so depressing.
I also read this morning that Bolsonaro was actually in the United States on January 6, 2021, as a guest of Ivanka Trump at the White House.
Oh, my God.
So the ties here are close-knit. It's really fascinating to see how Florida is becoming The Bulwark described it as like this mythical home of the MAGA movement, of this sort of global authoritarian movement. I'm curious to see what the Biden administration will do if Bolsonaro is in fact still in Florida and if the Brazilian court demands that he be brought back. He has kind of passively criticized the violence, but definitely encouraged what he says would be peaceful demonstrations against this election. He has not conceded the election.
Didn't go to the inauguration.
Yeah, we have the Trump doublespeak.
Again, same song, different verse.
It is. We'll continue to follow what's going on in Brazil. It is easy to feel down when we are in this conversation about January 6th and election denialism, and even the Speaker of the House story is not particularly encouraging. But what we really learned over the past year is that the future is not predetermined. What we do matters. And of course, all of our work here at Pantsuit Politics is premised on the idea that our relationships are extremely powerful in figuring out what the future will look like. So we are delighted to be joined for our next segment by Casper Turkheil. Casper is the author of The Power of Ritual. He is the co-founder of the Sacred Design Lab and co-creator of podcasts Harry Potter and the Sacred Text and The Real Question. He is one of my favorite voices and is widely celebrated on community trends and ritual and emerging spirituality. He's recently launched The Nearness, which he'll tell you about at the end of our conversation. And it's just a real thrill to have him here.
I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go. Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute, and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved, it's perfect for the sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now. And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready. Our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reads. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love. Chance encounters, a slow burn. Friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance through high-quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
I'm so delighted that you're here, Casper. Tell us your origin story of the version of you that's here. How did you go from climate activist to leading voice in rethinking spirituality and ritual and community? Let's start light and easy.
You know, quick, real quick.
Well, honestly, the older I get, the more the continuity feels like it's important, even if at the time it really felt like a lot of change. So I grew up in England. My parents are both from Holland, but they'd moved to the UK. And so I was born and raised in London and then in the countryside south of London. And we were a non-religious home, you know, in the UK. It's a very different kind of spiritual religious landscape to that of the US. So certainly when I, by the time I was a kid, it was kind of weird to be religious, and I didn't really know anyone who went to church. And so it was kind of, yeah, just an absence of institutional religion in my life. And that suited me just fine, because I came out when I was in my teens, and I was like, well, you know, God doesn't like gay people. Gay people don't like God. So bye. You know, it was kind of, it was a very simple breakup, if there had ever been anything there. And I really threw myself, as you mentioned, into climate activism. So I was trying to mobilize young people around the UN climate negotiations, and had that classic kind of activist experience of, after 3-4 years of really going all in, just burning out, just having nothing left in the tank, was the way I thought about it. And so I didn't know what to do with my life. I finished school and I'd loved my studies, but I, you know, just didn't know where to go with my life. And so I ended up in graduate school studying public policy, which was, you know, a useful, good thing for your resume. But I was suddenly much more interested in what these weird people across campus were doing at the Divinity School. And the way I like to position those two together is, in policy school, we asked, how do you, you know, reduce the recidivism rate? And in Divinity School, they were talking about, why do we have prisons? And so it was just a very different kind of conversation, and one that felt much more attuned to my heart, but I think also my existing skill set. Like, I'm not the best person to calculate a p-value. Like, I'm never going to be a quant wizard. I'm really good with people. And what I learned in Divinity School was how to take the things that I already had an interest in, like building community and creating culture and kind of getting to know how to do that much more skillfully, and to connect that to a much longer tradition of people who'd been doing it too. You know, how do you use food and song and dance and ritual to help build a sense of an us? And that just set my imagination aflame. And I started to, you know, even though I came into Divinity School as a gay atheist, you know, I'd like to joke that I left it still very gay, less of an atheist. but it really gave me a language and a discipline for the kind of things that I cared most about, which were meaning and culture and relationships. That's, I guess, how I ended up here.
I wonder if the word burnout that we so often use to describe people at that phase of life is even like the right word. Isn't it just developmentally appropriate? Isn't that what we do in our youth? Like, I have to remind myself all the time that my 13-year-old's legalistic thinking is developmentally appropriate. right? Like, we do this black and white thing, and we kind of dive in, and then we sort of start to break it down and reshape it. But you have to, I always think about Richard Rohr saying, like, you have to have an ego to break it down and reshape it. You know, it's like, this is sort of this inevitable path I think people find themselves on, because that is the work of your, you know, late teens and early 20s, is sort of diving in and finding your limits, right? It's not necessarily a bad thing. And I wonder how, as you, you know, age and develop other skills and lean into community and watch other people, young people take this journey, how you think about that phase of life.
That's a beautiful question. The language I would use now, rather than a kind of traditional burnout, is it was heartbreak, you know, because I believed what everyone had told me, which is that I could change the world. And I believed it because I saw other people doing it, right? It was so inspiring to be connected to young people around the world who were, you know, changing energy infrastructure and who were, you know, really involved and successful in what they were doing in Australia and India and Canada, like all around the world. That those were the people who were inspiring me. And so when I felt like I had failed because there was no UN climate agreement that was at the rigor that was necessary, you know, I'd been living in that story that it was my fault. And so that's what crushed me. And so I in my mind, I've moved away from that burnout language, which is kind of mechanistic and like there's nothing left in the tank, as I was just saying. And it was more about realizing that the story I had for myself about who I was in the world, it was just not true. And so I had to kind of find a new story about who I was. And so I think it's much more about a disconnect of meaning and reality than it was about not having energy.
Right. Yeah. It's like very, I think about you when you said heartbreak, I started to tear up because like that was, that was so how I felt at that stage. You just feel like it's all on you to fix it. Like you just think it's all on you as an individual to fix it. And you just want to grab their little, the kids and the young people on that stage and be like, hey, don't do that to yourself. Don't do that to yourself.
You know, I do think we're in that situation partly because we don't have the same kind of multi-generational activist infrastructure or like that experience of community where I didn't, you know, every youth movement has to create itself because it's like, there's no youth movement. We must do this. It's like, well, there was one 20 years ago. It's just they've aged out and they're not in relationship with us. And so we don't know about it. You know, and I think about that a lot now that I'm in my, mid to late 30s and feel, you know, I see younger people coming on the scene with all the same energy and you know, righteous critique, which I am grateful for because we need that. But I also, as you say, you can kind of see something coming down the line, and I can't catch everyone, but I've definitely made a couple of bets of being like, I'm going to stay, you know, close to you so that if and when this happens, you know, I'm at least I know about it and I can tell you you're not the first.
Sounds like community.
I hope so. And I was lucky, I should say, I had a couple of those mentors who paved the way for me to end up in divinity school, because Charlotte Miller in particular, you know, she was my age now. And she said, well, what is it that you love about singing? Why do you like bringing people together? Like, I just never connected those questions to what I thought was my purpose around, you know, climate stuff. And she helped build that bridge to show me there was a place for my gifts in a broader movement, maybe not the one I had been in.
I love how you said that you like thinking about how song and dance and ritual create a sense of us. It reminds me of a conversation we were having with my sister and her husband. Our kids love The Sound of Music, and we were watching the movie and talking about that moment where they're dancing this traditional Austrian dance, and about how, as adults, we're like looking at Captain Von Trapp, seeing him in a totally different way than we did as kids, and thinking like, wow, these songs are so meaningful to him and such a part of how he understands his relationship to his country. How can we get that here in America in 2022? How can we have a positive sense of national identity instead of this really negative attachment to nationalism? And I wonder if you see that kind of political dimension arising in all of this community work that you do, where people develop just a healthier expression of their connection to place when they are deeply rooted in community.
Well, first thing to say is I was so outraged when I realized that that piece of music was composed for the movie. It's not a traditional Austrian dance at all.
That is gutting. I might need a moment with that.
Always be sneaky like that, man.
Exactly. But I absolutely, dadgummit, I know that scene, and I the question is a good one. Gosh, I'll say just from my lived experience, you know, I've always had multiple national belongings. And so in some way that's made it, I now have three passports, which is bewildering, but it's made any love of country always, there's had to be space for multiple loves. And I think that's made it more safe in my mind to love one, because I know it's not in opposition to another. It can sit next to. I think that's how we have to think about a love of place. It's not that this place is better than anything else. Like, loving it doesn't It's never oppositional. It's always particular. And that's the thing that maybe gets lost even within a national love is the particularities of place. And that's why I love thinking about family traditions and local customs. And like, you know, when I meet someone from a new town, like I'm always curious, like what do you love about the place that you live? Like learning that Battle Creek, Michigan, and forgive me, this is also deeply ingrained in capitalism, but has like a national cereal day because that's where the Kellogg's headquarter is. And so they have a day where like all the cereals are free and you can, you know, they're all lined up on a table. Me too. Like, or you know, whatever weird and wonderful tradition your place has, I think is something to lean into. And it's the particularity that's the thing to love, not the comparality. I just made up a new word.
I think it's good. Good job. I mean, listen, one of our most popular Instagram posts this year was about local festivals.
Really?
People went off. People were in it.
Yeah.
They loved it. We started talking about a lentil festival, but now there's like a list of 50 festivals I'm going to have to go to. Well, and, you know, I think that particularity is such a good word, though, because I see that not just in our political discourse around place, but also our political discourse around identity.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is something really powerfully important about the discourse around masculinity. I'm raising three boys, and I think we've identified what we don't like about it, but we're having trouble articulating what is to love about positive masculinity. And I think that the part of it why we're coming up short is because we want to like intellectualize it and create it in our own brains. And I think what's so powerful about your work is that you're naming like, no. Like community and ritual is a place to form these places with each other, not on this individual journey.
Well, it's so hard to hold these two things in tension. The older I get, the more I think about that, like being able to live with paradox without freaking out and running to one of them is probably a sign of wisdom. But yes, we need particularity and we need community. And those two things are in tension because to be in community, we have to have something that we hold together. And that means a willingness to kind of, subsume our individual immediate needs and desires to what is healthiest for the group. And if we want our particularity, it's about centering ourselves. And I think, thank God we have lived, and this is Robert Beller's work that I'm drawing on here, but thank God we have lived in an age where a lot of the structures and the hierarchies of, and I'm talking here about a kind of Western world, which were deeply patriarchal and deeply classist and everything else, right, that we've tried to interrupt those systems and structures. And certainly as a queer man, I am super grateful for the freedoms that have come with that. In no way complete, in no way finished, but nonetheless, some progress. And yet, as that pendulum has swung from a society of structure and hierarchy towards one of more freedom and individual choice, more and more people feel disconnected, lonely, and like every interaction with someone else, you have to navigate because I don't know who we are in terms of status to one another. Like if I know it's my job to be subservient to you because you're a higher status, then I know what my role is in this encounter. If we have to figure it out every time we meet someone, it's just much more complex. And I think that's why you're seeing so much interest in the conversation about identity and particularities, because we're trying to figure out, well, who am I if I'm not the function I serve in society? That might be overly complex, but what I see happening now is a kind of desire to find some new structure that hopefully maintains the freedoms that we have, but also gives us some way of being in relationship to each other that isn't dependent on our own creativity. Because if I have to go and like build the container for a relationship every day, it's exhausting. Yeah. And I think that's why everyone's just like, I can't even.
Well, and think about that politically, like in a context of not just societal, but like our media environment. We're bombarded by like these new societal minefields. We're bombarded by all this incredible information, which also feeds those societal minefields. Like, it's a lot for our brains.
And we don't have the communities that we're in where we encounter one another across difference to know that we're not always dangerous to each other. I want to be careful about how I frame that. There are absolutely times where there is real danger. But the narrative, I think, of us versus them becomes so much more toxic when you don't have any thems in your life that you love.
Mm.
And so I'm really interested in the kind of strategic question of how do we build containers of relationship where I don't have to like you to love you. That's really missing.
Well, and layered on top of all of that is a particular form of status where the kind of earnestness required to even figure out what these containers are is a little bit unsophisticated, right? We don't use words like trust and honesty and loyalty without a little bit of an eye roll or something. That's my professional background. You know, I came up through the legal profession, and being in a very well-respected firm, I just noticed that earnestness was like not for us here. That belonged to another social class. We wouldn't name it that way, but it did. Mm. And so getting to do the work that we do now, where we're constantly saying, well, like, what value is exhibited through this political work, is really refreshing. And it also requires an undoing of all that learning. So I wondered, because you're so good at just leaning into that earnestness, if that's something that you've deliberately cultivated in your work, or sort of what sustains that for you?
Well, and not for nothing, Harry Potter was like that door to earnestness for so many people. That's why it's so beloved. That is why that text is sacred, as you would call it, or beloved, because it allowed that earnestness again. I really think that's part of its appeal.
I think that's so insightful. Gosh, well, I'm not sure I am very good at it. I'm hesitant to say it. But I think maybe one of the things that I grew up learning, like our household was very open in the sense that my mother ran a bed and breakfast in our house. We always had people staying. Like, our kitchen was always filled with someone. And that was deeply frustrating as a child. I hated it. Because it meant I wasn't getting the attention I wanted. And of course, I was the most important thing. Plus, I had three sisters. You know, there was just a lot happening. But I think the thing I learned from my mother is that everyone is interesting once you get them talking. And that's certainly the way I think I live. If I have enough, if I have enough sleep and I'm not running on empty. But once you get people talking, there's always something that's interesting and therefore something to love. And so I think with that kind of foundational assumption about the world, it's just a different way of entering into it. That's not always how I am. I don't want to paint myself in any sort of saintly way, but it certainly is there when I show up with that kind of orientation. And when you believe it enough, I think maybe this is one of the things that I do, is that other people then dare to believe it too. And so with the Harry Potter podcast, you know, I was never an expert in text study or an expert even in Harry Potter. A lot of people know much more about that series than I do. But with Vanessa and Ariana, our producer, you know, we were able to model something, I think, that made it safe for other people to do that too. And they took it in a wonderful 100 different directions from where we did. We had people setting up small groups and all sorts of other wonderful things. But just returning to a text with the kind of intention and attention and repetition over time, it made something new that was possible, that was really exciting.
Well, and I think that earnestness, that invitational energy is cyclical in the same way like loneliness can be. We did a show on loneliness and we talked about like if you're alone and then you feel excluded and then you start to distrust your interactions with other people, so you seclude yourself. And in the same way, if you are earnest and sort of open-hearted, even when people treat you badly, like you have enough muscle memory to continue to lean in, to continue to engage. And like podcasting, I think, is a particularly good venue for this because of that repetition you speak to around rituals in your book. Like you just show up, and Beth always says it's like the dairy farm, the cows have to get milk. So like we just got to go out there and we have to engage and open ourselves up again and do it again and continue that work, because there is a part of our brains, even on these very like deeply emotional levels. And I'm using brains, and I think I probably should use the word spirit, which is what you speak to, like sort of that spirituality that is both higher level, but also needs that like that daily repetition. It's muscle memory is not the word I need. It's like a spiritual habit, you know, and that's what builds it, and it builds on itself, both good ways and bad.
I mean, the other thing that strikes me is for us with the podcast, and I'm sure this is true for the two of you as well, like at the heart of that project was just a really deep friendship, like was just love. You know, when you feel invited into something like that, it feels good, right? We all want that. And so in every project that I've done that succeeded, I've never done it by myself. It's always been with someone. And I've just had to learn the hard way that I can't do it alone. Little Chicago reference there for you musical fans. But and so for me, the work then becomes not how do I have a great idea, but how do I find someone who cares about the questions that I care about enough to risk creating something together? You know, how do we build the trust between us to be deep enough to navigate the conflict that will inevitably arise? And that's the thing I'm most grateful for in all of this is like, I've just been very lucky enough to find wonderful collaborators and friends. And I think we all need that to some extent.
Well, that's a great opening to ask you to tell us about the nearness. What you're creating now and what's going on with that project.
You know, I mentioned my interest in kind of how do we build the containers that hold relationships, you know, in a time where we're all drowning in fabulous content, you know, and I listen and create my own pile of that, you know, whether it's books or podcasts or you know, YouTube videos or movies, whatever. And so we have access to content in a way that's totally unparalleled. But what we're so often missing are the containers of relationship within which we get to make meaning of that. Like, hey, did you watch that series 3 of whatever? Yes. Okay, great. Me too. But like, how can we actually talk about it in more depth? Or, you know, what are the stories of my own life that I'd like to talk about more with other people who've shared similar experiences? Or and any place where we can really get to that kind of deeper meaning. And so the nearness is designed to help us feel more connected to ourselves, one another, and the world around us. And it does that through a sort of 6-week journey in small groups. And so you sign up to be in a small group with 6 or 7 other people. You get together at the same time every week for 6 weeks. It all happens on Zoom. And we guide you through with a kind of guided conversation, a series of reflections and conversations and invitations to make a commitment to the coming week that hopefully helps people really nurture that part of their lives that, you know, speaks to the things of ultimate importance. So it's been really lovely to see. We've gone through a couple of these journeys now with people signing up. And it's, you know, for any spiritual and religious affiliation or none, it's really designed for a very diverse context. So there's no assumption of shared belief or practice, but what is shared is a commitment to be in relationship with each other. So yeah, that's what the nearness is all about.
I love that. And I wonder, as you do this work, you know, it's inevitable. What we're talking about here is human beings.
Oh, yeah.
Who will upset and disappoint you, especially the more diverse the audience. And I wonder what you've learned as you've navigated that disappointment around J.K. Rowling. I mean, Harry Potter has all this wisdom and beauty. It's all here for all of us. I would actually particularly like you to just help me put words when I get into it with my 13-year-old about this. That'd be great. Like, you just write some sort of script for me, even though this is supposed to be the stuff we do. But I think that's it's really hard because humans inevitably disappoint us or take positions, especially when we're talking about politics, that we don't like. That lens of ritual and community, how do you navigate that?
Yeah, I love that, Sarah. I literally, in an info session for the nearness just a few hours ago, I was saying, you will fall in love with your small group and they'll disappoint you. And that is part of the experience. So we're very upfront because if there's anything I can be assured of, it's that, you know, we'll disappoint each other at some point. And it was really disappointing, you know, when J.K. Rowling came out, not with her first transphobic missive, that had already happened, but it was this double down,
kind
of vitriolic, like, essay that had just gone into so much. There was clearly so much pain there for her, and I can't comment beyond that in terms of her experience, but I was very grateful that from the beginning we had said we're not interested in authorial intent. We're interested in a reader's engagement with the text. So to some extent, we were protected by, you know, not being very interested in the author from the beginning. We cared about how people were reading the text. But we absolutely asked ourselves, can we ethically continue with this project, you know? And so we did as best we could what I hope anyone would do, which is to ask the audience and say, hey, like, what are your thoughts? What do you think? And in particular, we were interested in hearing from trans and non-binary listeners who are obviously the most impacted by J.K. Rowling's comments. And we did a whole episode where we just shared voice notes, voicemail messages from trans and non-binary listeners. And, you know, as ever, it wasn't like one community response. There were people who said, I can never read this book again. I am heartbroken. This woman has ruined something that was so important for me. I can't be part of this anymore. And there were other people who said, how dare she? This book doesn't belong to her anymore. It's our story. And she can't just take it away from us by going on this horrific vitriolic rant. And other people landed somewhere in between. And so that's how we continued the conversation, was by making space, I hope, for all of those, and inviting people to do what was right for them. We ultimately decided to continue with the podcast with some changes that the next time we read it through. And so now my co-host and co-creator Vanessa Zoltan is reading it with my former literature and religion professor, Matthew Potts. So the audience got a real upgrade there. They've got a Harvard professor leading them through the text now. But they have a real commitment to be more critical of the text, because there's so much wrong with it, as there is with any text. Because guess what? There's a lot wrong with the world. And so that was our reaction to it. Probably not perfect, but I'm also really invested in, you know, in the same way of creating containers, is how do we cultivate a relational space in which, as you said, hurt and disappointment are not a threat. They are an expectation. And so for me, the practice of covenant as a community is one that I'm really passionate about, because I think it gives us a way back towards each other when, not if, we hurt each other.
Mm, I love that so much. I think that's it. That's it, right? We call each other in instead of calling each other out, right? I mean, and that's, I think that the idea that we're not fixing it, there is no perfect response available to us. That the only path forward is forward, not to some destination.
That calls me back to your activism time and thinking about how we have an audience of people who are frequently disappointed and heartbroken and find staying engaged with the news really challenging, but also a commitment that they've made to care about the world around them. So having integrated all of these experiences that you've had and all the work that you've done, I wonder if you went back in time and were advising your younger self at the beginning of that climate activism journey, what you would share.
I hope I could invite him to pay attention to the people who've stayed committed in the long haul. For me, that was, and I guess I did this a little bit as a young man, but one of the reasons I ended up in divinity school is because I kept noticing that the people who were still committed had some sort of spirituality thing going on. And I didn't know what to make of that. It felt weird to me, especially with activists who've kept going a long time. You know, you can burn off anger for a while, but that can't be the thing that sustains you forever. Or if it does, boy, is that going to be a difficult, difficult life. I think there has to be a wellspring of love from which you can be angry. It's not that anger has no space in activism, but there has to be a rootedness in something good that carries us all through. Otherwise, I think we become pretty bitter and not good for each other, honestly, over time. So I hope I would encourage myself to notice who are the people who are rooted in goodness, and to figure out how I can root myself in that same goodness, whatever language I'd use for it, to sustain me and not just to be going off the kind of indignant outrage that was definitely the fuel at that point.
Listened to an interview with Bill McGibbon, a longtime climate activist.
Yeah.
And it's like the climate activism community, all of us that care about the climate are entering a new phase. It's like, it's the building phase now. We've sort of, you know, what you're doing is climate activism, finding, you know, containers for relationship and community organizations, because we are entering a new phase where we are not in this space where we're trying to, you know, get the data or convince people. We have historical climate change legislation here in the United States, and we're on the cusp of all this, you know, renewable energy technology, where it's time to pivot. It's time to move into a different place that is fueled by love and building and the future, and not this sort of righteous anger at how things were done badly in the past.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, because that's how it works in my head as well. Is, you know, I was really involved in kind of mitigation work. So like, how do you reduce the output of carbon emissions amongst other fossil fuel emissions? But now I think of my work as more about adaptation. So look, we're already in a world where there are climate refugees. We know we're going to be resource strapped in terms of access to water and so much else. So what is the culture going to look like when that really arrives at our own doorstep? And Rebecca Solnit's work has been so important for me in kind of looking at immediate disaster responses, when we see the, you know, yes, you see the worst of people now and then, but mostly you see the best of people in those immediate responses to disasters. The capacity for mutual aid and mutual support and the generosity and goodness that comes out of people in those moments is so amazing. And I want to cultivate that so that when, you know, when the time comes, so that we're asked, like, I mean, my parents just had this, like, they're housing two Ukrainian refugees and have been doing since March. And as are 60 other households in the village that I grew up in, you know, because people needed a place to go. And so how can we train ourselves to be ready to give what we can when we need to, which is all the time. And I love that you mentioned Bill, because he's a friend of mine and such an inspiration. And like, to see that man walk or ski or swim or like do anything in the natural world is to see a man in love with nature. And so like, he's so fueled by that in his daily life, you know, maddeningly so. To hike with him is just like running behind him, keeping up, even though he's like four decades older than me. But like, he embodies that in such a beautiful way.
Well, I think you do too. And I think that this work you're doing is so important, and it will fuel this next phase. And we thank you so much for your work. It's definitely affected both of us tremendously.
I so appreciate you both doing the work that you're doing. And thanks for having me and everyone who's listening. I know they're, you know, fighting the good fight wherever they are. So really grateful for everyone.
Listen, y'all, let's be serious. I'm 42 years old. Of course, I take my skincare routine seriously. There are a lot of daily skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, but how do you know your products are actually working? Well, Ritual is here for you. They have Hyacera, their once daily skin supplement, clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. They conducted a clinical study, and it led to a 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet within 90 days as compared to a placebo, and a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. I love taking my Hyacera every day as part of my skincare routine instead of just slathering more products on my face. It feels like I'm doing something from the inside out. And their one daily capsule is essenced with soothing vanilla, so it's a very pleasant experience. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never-frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious, and Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code PANTSUIT50 at factormeals.com/PANTSUIT50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15. Thank you so much to Casper Turkile for joining us. Sarah, our outside of politics today is an obvious topic considering the conversation with Casper, because he focuses so beautifully on community. And we got a very tangible manifestation of our community through their holiday cards that I finally got to read. I'm so mad that our P.O. box is in Paducah and that I had to wait so long to get them, but I finally got to read them and it was wonderful.
You know, we had that conversation in December. I don't really know how it kind of fell out that the P.O. box started getting shared and people started sending their holiday cards, but I mean, the last time I went, there were 70 in there. And to hold this big fat stack with your handwriting and your faces and your beautiful children and families and vacations, I just cannot say enough about what an incredible blessing it was to receive these cards from all of you.
It really was. You all have excellent taste. Mm-hmm. You are so photogenic.
I thought it was so pretty. So pretty.
I loved seeing your handwriting, just like you said, Sarah. Even many of you like would stick a post-it note, mm-hmm. just saying hi to us with the Christmas card. It was so fun. You are clever and excellent writers. There were so many fun. I read everybody's long letters about their mm-hmm. lives. Mm-hmm. I know about your dogs and your jobs and your moves and the babies that you all are expecting. I really appreciated how many people included something that was kind of hard about yep. their year. Memorial to someone who's passed away or a sickness or just the fact that their lives are consumed by therapy appointments and doctor's visits. It was very real. And I loved getting to feel that realness in my hands in my living room.
Absolutely. And this is not a competition. But I have to shout out a couple very specific cards that delighted me to no end. And I think speak to exactly what you're talking about. First of all, you guys, MVP for a couple reasons. Liz Mobley, she does a singles card. We talked about how we love a singles card. We got so many. They were all so good.
The singles cards made me feel like I really need to up my game on our cards.
Because they're better.
So good.
They're good. They can't lean on a cute baby, but you know what I'm saying? Like, they got to really bring it. And they did, Liz. You guys. So she writes new lyrics to a Christmas song. They are legitimately funny. And here's where she really shines. You guys, she said, I know Sarah likes a collection. You guys, she sent them for like the last 5 years. We got like all five that she since she's been doing this. I cannot. I had to take a minute. I had to just stop and just be in it. I sang along to the lyrics. Like, I loved it, Liz, to reference the collection and send them all. Because listen, that's a big deal to save, to know you have extras, to package up the complete collection of extras you have saved and send them to us. Like, Liz, understand, I feel it. I get it. Incredible.
I thought Crystal also deserved a shout out for having her adult children replicate their picture on Santa's lap.
This energy, you guys. And she like puts a picture of all the previous years in a Christmas ornament on the card and then the newest one on the back with her adult children sitting with Santa. I cannot.
I noticed that Simba and Betsy's card just felt like an ongoing celebration because mm-hmm. there are wedding pictures. There's the baby announcement. It was like someone jumping out of a cake and saying, we have all the good news over here.
Yep.
And I was so happy for them.
Also, I have to shout out Abby. Abby writes a letter. The whole letter was hilarious. But y'all, she described her toddler. She said, who has the emotional stability of a sleep-deprived preteen and the communication skills of a domesticated parent. I died. I've read it to like five people. It's such a good description of a toddler. Oh, my God.
Well, thank you for sharing your cards with us. It was just The most special surprise. I could never have imagined getting to know you all a little bit better in this way. And it was so much fun.
Wait, I have one more. I have to squeeze in one more shout out. This is like a level of life as represented by it by Christmas card that it was like the Mount Everest situation. Okay, y'all, Rachel has 4 children. She serves in the National Guard. She runs marathons. And then she also writes a letter where she assigns everyone in her family their own special song. Rachel, you're making all the rest of us look very lazy. No, she doesn't. I just was very impressed. And I was like, that needs a shout out too, because that's a lot. These are little kids too. They're not grown.
And to the fact that it's not a competition, I equally loved the people who just like selected a beautiful card and wrote a note inside. Like it was very consistent with the conversation we had about cards before the holiday. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't matter what it is or how it's done. It's just lovely to get mail from a person to you. It's just really lovely.
There were homemade cards. You guys, Nicole sent us baklava because she makes 1,000 pieces of homemade baklava to send out on the holidays. Like, what is even... I like the person, too, who was like, you got a papyrus card. That's how you know I love you. We are sending these cards around to our team. Everyone is going to get to see and read them because they are... I kind of wish I could just pack, like, maybe I'll just send them down the list of Christmas cards so you guys can sit with your own stack and just soak up the love because you are the most incredible community.
Speaking of being an incredible community, don't forget that if you'd like to be part of reading the January 6th report with us in community, to sign up for More to Say through our premium content on either Apple Podcast subscriptions or Patreon. There are links in the show notes for that. We will be back in your ears this Friday. Until then, we hope you have the best week available to you. Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production. Elise Knapp is our managing director.
Maggie Penton is our community engagement manager. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Martha Brunitsky.
Hallie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Helen Handley.
Tiffany Hassler.
Emily Holiday.
Katie Johnson.
Katina Zuganellis-Kasling.
Barry Kaufman.
Molly Kors.
Catherine Vollmer.
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
Linda Daniel.
Emily Neasley.
The Pettons!
Tawny Peterson.
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Katie Steigers.
Karen True.
Annika Uvaline.
Nick and Elisa Vallelli.
Amy Whited.
Emily Helen Olson.
Lee Shay McDonough.
Jeff Davis. Melinda Johnston. Michelle Wood. Joshua Allen. Morgan McHugh. Nicole Berkless, Paula Bremer, and Tim Miller.